Hello and welcome to the October podcast for the ISB's discussions on insurance contracts. My name is Andrea Pride. I'm joined today by Daryl Scott, and we're going to talk you through the decisions that the board made last week. There were two biggish topics, I think, earned premium and participating contracts, and then a sort of boring but important topic on the subject of transition effective date comparators and early application. And also we did some other small pieces of housekeeping around the premium allocation approach last week. But let's start with the earned premium approach. Daryl, I think this is a topic that we've been gearing up to, in a sense, over quite a number of months, and we finally made a decision which I think is consistent with what we've been doing in the past in terms of the measurement of the liability, but also really consistent with some of the other decisions you've taken in the revenue recognition project.
Andrea, I thought we made very positive progress this month on that. It was particularly heartening that there was substantial majorities on both boards who were in favour of the earned premium approach. As you mentioned, the earned premium approach we believe is consistent with the approach that is taken in revenue. It aligns then the top number in the income statement of an insurer with that of any other industry by having a revenue number that's there. I think what was also interesting about the debate we had in between the two boards was that both boards discussed in a fair amount of detail the alternatives, premium due and premium written, and I think substantially rejected those alternatives. To the extent that we had board members either voting for or expressing alternate views, those alternative views were substantially in favour of summarised margin. So I think it's really useful that we're going out to our constituents presenting two very clear options here, the earned premium option or, at the opposite end of the scale, the summarised margin.
Yes, so I guess what that's really saying is that when we went out with the exposure draft, obviously we proposed a summarised margin approach when you wouldn't have any revenue or claims. The overwhelming message we got from constituents was that they wanted to see some money in less some expenses equaling a profit type presentation, because that was consistent with what other industries do. The boards have now come and said, well, that's fine as long as it is consistent with what other industries do. So if you're going to have a top-line volume indicator, it needs to be consistent with commonly understood concepts of revenue. And so if on evaluation constituents find that the benefits of providing that information don't outweigh the costs of providing it for insurance contracts, then that's an evaluation we'll have to make at the time. And because this is one of the targeted areas for our exposure draft, then there will be opportunity to do that. Thank you. Moving on to the next topic, another fairly big topic, but much less discussion this time, and it was around participating contracts. And I think the problem there has been that we've made decisions in participating contracts and other decisions for all contracts, and I think particularly some board members haven't really found that they've understood how it all ties together and how the different decisions interact. And what really brought it to a head was the discussion on other comprehensive income. And we said at that point we'd come back and show you what exactly we meant and what your existing decisions were. So what did you make of the discussion there?
I thought it was a very interesting discussion between the boards. I think what was useful for us was to get an understanding of exactly how the mechanics of the mirroring approach under participating contracts works. As you mentioned, we made this decision a while back, and in the intervening period we made a decision around other comprehensive income, the treatment of other comprehensive income, and I think some concern had been created by people trying to imagine how those two would interact or how they would work together. The papers that we saw and the discussion that we had this month, I think, were useful in clarifying both how the principle works, importantly in clarifying the board's views that the concept of mirroring under participating contracts trumps the concept of OCI. In other words, if you have participating contracts, and participating contracts are those contracts where the asset and the liability are contractually linked, where you have those participating contracts, you will look first to mirroring. And if the underlying is in OCI, then the liability will be OCI. But if the underlying is not treated through OCI, then by the same token, the liability won't go through OCI.
Yep, and I think it's important to realise that we're talking about participating features in contracts rather than particular types of contracts themselves, because as we've seen in previous board papers on participating contracts, there's a huge variety of different types of contracts, and rather than trying to come up with a model for each, we're trying to identify the feature which which deserves particular attention, and in this case it's the contractual link to an underlying item, be that assets, liabilities, assets and liabilities, surplus in an entity, or whatever the underlying item is. So the last topic I think we should talk about today is what I characterise as boring but important, and of course it's important. We're talking about transition, effective date, comparatives, early adoption, all the things that happen when you apply a standard for the first time and how you apply it for the first time. On transition, probably not a great deal to report other than that we're making things slightly easier with an expedient that, rather than trying to distinguish when you knew a change in estimate from when you from an experience adjustment, we're seeing that you can just treat all changes in estimates as if they had been known at the inception of the contract, so you don't have to divide the changes in estimate anymore. On the effective date, comparators and early application, would you like to fill us in on that, please, Daryl?
Maybe as a starting point, it's perhaps worth saying that it would be very unusual for us at the exposure draft stage of our process to give the type of information that we decided on in the last board meeting. But we felt it was becoming really important for constituents, particularly preparers, to start understanding the timelines, what the timelines were that we were planning, and to start planning and thinking about the interaction between this standard and the other standards that we'll be releasing over the next couple of years. So at the outset, the board discussed the period of time between the finalisation of the standard and the first compulsory effective date that would be required. And we decided that that period should be approximately 3 years, that a 3-year period gave preparers sufficient time to actually adapt their systems to what they're required to do. We're not going to be very specific about it because we don't know the exact dates that we'll complete the standard. But approximately 3 years as a term, we think, gives our preparers enough time to start thinking about the implications.
And sorry to interrupt, but I think it's important, given that we're going out with a limited re-exposure, that we'd expect that people would be able to start preparations, at least on the parts of the model that we don't intend to re-expose.
Certainly. I think a lot of the preparers are going to have an awful lot of information coming out of this exposure process on which they can start to base some of the decisions they're going to need to make, start to get an understanding of what they need to do in order to implement the standard. And I think the fact that the board has on several times made it fairly clear that we want to limit the changes that we make out of this exposure process does give a certain amount of certainty to preparers in terms of that planning process. Just to add a couple of the other decisions which we thought were quite important, I think, in this meeting. The first one is that we believe comparatives are necessary in this circumstance. Comparatives are something that we require as a given, generally speaking, when preparers adopt a new accounting standard, but we do from time to time provide exceptions. Given the circumstances here, fairly long lead time, a long ability to actually see what's coming, and the extent of the changes in the underlying system, the underlying numbers, we believe it is important that insurers can provide comparatives, and so we've required comparatives in all circumstances. The final decision we made was taking account of the fact that we would expect IFRS 9 to have an effective date probably quite some time before the effective date of the final insurance standard, and that there are some insurers out there who may wish to actually have concurrent dates for the adoption of the two standards. We've allowed early adoption. We've allowed it for a couple of reasons. The one, as I mentioned, is IFRS 9, but a second one that's equally important is that IFRS 4, as it stands at the moment, provides considerable leeway for insurers and would probably have allowed insurers to early adopt many of the features of our current model in any case. So allowing early adoption is something of a pragmatic decision as much as anything else.
Yeah, and just to address some of the concerns that we've heard about not being able to apply IFRS 9 and the new insurance contract standard at the same time, we've provided a relief there as well in terms of redesignation of financial assets. So to the extent that you would get a new mismatch or you no longer have a mismatch from applying the new insurance contract standard, you could either designate or revoke a previous designation, which you wouldn't normally be permitted to in IFRS 9. And then for equities through OCI, which is a free choice designation in IFRS 9, we've also provided an opportunity to make that designation again when you apply the insurance contract standard.
That's right. Again, it's really important that if you're looking at IFRS 9 in this context, there are perhaps two parts of IFRS 9. There's those parts that are based on the business model, and the business model is in essence a factual test. And so you can't be retrospective or restate anything for a factual test. So that component of IFRS 9 you wouldn't be able to do anything about other than to the extent that you change a business model. On the other side, there are parts of IFRS 9 that are, generally speaking, limited options, and we've simply allowed those limited options to be revisited once this change actually happens.
Okay, well, that's great. I think that does us for this month's meeting, and we look forward to updating you on the next month's meeting. Thanks for listening.